Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the November 17th, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week shows President Joe Biden. He's driving his now familiar classic green convertible Corvette, has both hands on the steering wheel, a concerned look on his face. His passenger is the Democratic donkey with a panicked look on his face. They're stuck on a railroad crossing with the bar coming down in front of the car, and not too far away, 100-200 yards, is a big freight train coming right at them. The headline is "Warning Sign: Should Democrats Panic Over Biden's Poll Numbers?" That is a one of the talking points articles. We will start with one of the main stories and how it was covered. Democrats score state wins with focus on abortion. What happened? Abortion rights advocates celebrated victory after victory in state elections this week, a sign the issue could be a potent driver of votes for Democrats in 2024. By a resounding 57% to 43%, Ohio voters approved a ballot measure establishing the right to reproductive choice in the state constitution. Republican Governor Mike DeWine had signed a 2019 trigger ban that became law after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. But the new amendment bars the state from restricting abortions before fetal viability, generally considered to be 22 to 24 weeks of pregnancy. In Virginia, Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin had spent political capital and millions of dollars in campaign funds to try to consolidate GOP control of the state legislature so that he could pass a law allowing abortion only up to 15 weeks of pregnancy. Instead, Democrats retained their majority in the state Senate and took back control of the House. In Pennsylvania, Democrats ran abortion-centered ads that helped Daniel McCaffrey win the open seat on the state Supreme Court, preserving its liberal majority. And in Kentucky, Democratic Governor Andy Beshear handily won re-election against anti-abortion state Attorney General Daniel Cameron. Still, Democrats did not prevail everywhere. In Mississippi, Republican Governor Tate Reeves defeated challenger Brandon Presley, a distant relative of Elvis, despite allegations that he had misspent $77 million in welfare funds. And while Ohio liberals celebrated the passage of the state ballot measure, with advocate Dr. Marcella Azevedo saying, "We're going to bed knowing that we own our own bodies," Republicans said they would not give up the effort to restrict abortion access. "This is not the end of the conversation," said Ohio's House Speaker Jason Stevens. What the columnist said: Democrats continue to perform better at the polls than in the polls, said Ronald Brownstein in The Atlantic. They were panicking over polls showing President Biden's extreme vulnerability in next year's presidential race. But even in states President Trump won twice, such as Kentucky and Ohio, the Democratic focus on cultural issues fueled turnout in cities. That could prove a winning formula in 2024, too. However disenchanted voters are with Biden's performance, they also fear what Republicans would do with power. And they certainly do not like abortion bans, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon. Since Roe was overturned, the pro-choice side has prevailed in all seven states where the question was put directly to voters. It's a highly motivating issue. Beshear's campaign in Kentucky, for example, included a powerful ad featuring a woman, 21, who'd been raped by her stepfather at age 12. She asked voters whether children in such circumstances should be forced through pregnancy and birth, and now they've answered no. If the GOP remains so out of step with most Americans on abortion, it will surely pay a price at the ballot box. That doesn't mean Republicans should abandon the unborn, the most important human rights cause of our time, said National Review in an editorial. The Ohio measure was written misleadingly, and plenty of Republicans, including Ohio's DeWine and Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, have championed abortion limits and won re-election. Yes, the pro-life movement still has to change many more hearts and minds, but for now it can at least pursue prudent legislative compromises, such as a 15-week abortion ban. But Youngkin tried that, and it didn't work, said James Simica in the Dispatch. Virginians chose him in 2021 because he tapped into the anger and frustration of parents over COVID school closures and masking. Those grievances feel less relevant in the return to pre-pandemic normal, and his attempt at framing a 15-week abortion ban as a compromise and implicitly a national GOP blueprint failed to convince a still purple electorate. So much for the draft Youngkin movement, said Michael Bender in the New York Times. Some GOP donors wanted him to make a late run for president, hoping he could work his magic on moderate voters turned off by the Trump era. He's now ruled that out. The Democratic gains this week don't guarantee success next year, said Stephen Shepard in Politico. Low-income, non-college-educated voters tend not to vote in these off-year races, and such voters have been shifting toward Trump. Trump is trouncing Biden in poll after poll, and Democrats are underdogs to hold their Senate majority. Still, this week's results might at least signal that doom and gloom over the 2024 race is just as premature as triumphalism. We still have a year to go. The controversy of the week. Supreme Court. Do domestic abusers have a right to guns? The Supreme Court's conservative supermajority has already turned the Second Amendment into a runaway train, said Linda Greenhouse in the New York Times. How the justices decide the case they heard this week, United States versus Rahimi, will tell us whether the train has jumped the tracks entirely. The case centers on Zaki Rahimi, who in 2019 assaulted his girlfriend in a parking lot and shot at a bystander. A Texas judge hit Rahimi, now 23, with a restraining order and barred him from having guns. But Rahimi kept and repeatedly used his firearms over the next 6 months, once firing in the air after his friend's credit card was declined at Whataburger. He was eventually sentenced to 6 years in prison under a federal law barring firearms from anyone subject to a domestic violence court order. Then came Bruin, said Jay Willis in Slate. In last year's bombshell decision, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote that all gun control laws must be grounded in the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. No law in the 1700s banned wife beaters from packing heat, and so the ultra-conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned Rahimi's conviction, ruling the 1994 federal law unconstitutional. The Supreme Court's right-wingers must now decide whether to keep that dangerous decision or to toss it and admit Bruin was a jurisprudential train wreck. It looks like common sense will prevail for now, said Jill Filipovich in CNN. A majority of the justices seemed persuaded by the argument from Solicitor General Elizabeth Preloger that many states have a historical tradition of keeping guns from dangerous or irresponsible individuals, including loyalists in the Revolutionary War and miners and drunks in the 19th century. when Rahimi's lawyer asked for a definition of dangerous, Chief Justice John Roberts suggested his client's habit of shooting, you know, at people might be a good start. Rahimi's trigger happiness isn't unusual among domestic abusers. A 2018 study found that nearly 1 million women say they've been shot or shot at by an abusive partner, while other research shows 68% of mass shootings from 2014 to 2019 were committed by domestic abusers. Rahimi isn't the sort of person who should be carrying a gun, said Carrie Sloan in the Wall Street Journal, but his case will have legal implications for many people who aren't like him. The real question facing the Supreme Court is the standard of evidence needed to strip people of constitutional rights. And the standard in civil cases, like the one that resulted in Rahimi's initial gun ban, is much lower than that required in criminal cases. Should Americans lose their Second Amendment rights after a non-criminal proceeding, which may not even involve a public hearing or a lawyer? That seems a violation of what the founders intended. But the founders could not have anticipated today's weaponry, said Ian Milheiser in Vox. The semi-automatic handguns and rifles of 2023 have little in common with the single-shot muskets of the 1700s. The real test of Bruin is not Rahimi, but the upcoming Garland versus Cargill, which challenges the ban on bump stocks passed after the 2017 massacre of 60 people in Las Vegas. If Bruin means Congress can't ban devices that turn rifles into machine guns, shooting 90 bullets in 10 seconds, the odds of any future gun law passing muster look remote. In the name of originalism, our Trumpified Supreme Court will further transform America into a slaughterhouse that would be unrecognizable to the framers. This Good Week, Bad Week piece. It's a good week for disambiguation. After Sweden launched a public relations campaign to stop tourists from mistaking it for Switzerland, a video ad notes that one way to tell the two European nations apart, Switzerland has yodeling, while Sweden has silence and a lack of yodeling. It was a good week for planning after some 240 Argentine Taylor Swift fans spent 5 months camping on the streets of Buenos Aires to secure front row seats for a Swift show in the city. The Swifties occupied four large tents in rotating shifts determined by an internal spreadsheet. It was a good week for water sports. After a pod of orcas rammed and sank a yacht in the Strait of Gibraltar, the fourth boat to be sunk off the Iberian Peninsula by the animals in the past 2 years. Experts suspect the boat's rudders are viewed as playthings by fun-seeking young orcas. But it was a bad week for damage control. After Florida Governor Ron DeSantis responded to claims that he wears lifts in his cowboy boots by accusing his height skeptics of having foot fetishes, and by making a curious offer to wear a boot on my head at the next Republican debate. It's a bad week for corporal punishment. After The Simpsons retired one of its longest-running gags, Homer Simpson strangling his son Bart. "I don't do that anymore," the cartoon patriarch says in the third episode of the 35th season. Times have changed. Finally, it was a bad week for freedom of expression. After a string of complaints led a British judge to ban Joshua Hunt, 32, from wearing his all-black, skin-tight, face-covering gimp suit out at night for the next 5 years and or crawling, wriggling, or writhing on the ground in a public space. The briefing this week, Magic Mushrooms and the Mind. A growing number of states and cities are legalizing the use of psychedelic fungi in therapy. Some experts think that's a big risk. Are magic mushrooms legal? Not under federal law, which has classified the fungi as a highly dangerous Schedule I drug since 1970. But a campaign to decriminalize psilocybin, the mind-altering compound in magic mushrooms, is gaining pace at the state and local level. This summer, Oregon became the first state to allow the use of psilocybin in mental health care. Colorado intends to follow suit in 2025, and San Francisco, Detroit, Washington, D.C., and other cities have voted in recent years to decriminalize psilocybin. At licensed therapy facilities in Oregon, patients take mushrooms from a state-approved grower under the guidance of a certified facilitator, or trip sitter. The effect is much more than rainbows and unicorns, Josh Goldstein, a psilocybin facilitator in Bend, told the New York Times. At one recent session overseen by Goldstein, a Marine veteran struggling with PTSD said the psilocybin triggered visions of colorful ribbons wrapping around painful thoughts. It was like a massive weight had been released, said the veteran. It sounds rather trippy, but a growing body of research indicates psilocybin could help relieve depression, addiction, anxiety, and many other mental health conditions. There is a lot of hype, said Dr. Joshua Gordon, director of the National Institute of Mental Health, and a lot of hope. How does psilocybin therapy work? Research suggests that psilocybin can rewire the brain by generating new connections between neurons. The feeling of altered consciousness experienced during a mushroom trip, including kaleidoscopic visions and hallucinations, is a result of unusual linkages forming among parts of the brain that handle auditory and visual information and executive and sense of self functions. Such disruption can be therapeutic, said David Nutt, a psychopharmacologist at Imperial College London. Depressed people are continually self-critical, and they keep ruminating, going over and over the same negative, anxious, or fearful thoughts, he explains. Psilocybin breaks the brain out of that familiar pattern, so critical thoughts are easier to control, and thinking is more flexible. How long do the effects last? Psilocybin's immediate psychedelic effects typically peak around 60 to 90 minutes after the drug has been consumed, but can go on for up to 8 hours. The new brain connections forged during those trips last much longer, at least a month in mice treated with psilocybin. Such long-lasting effects might eventually allow people with depression to curb their use of traditional antidepressants, perhaps taking the medications only once a week or month, said David Olson, a psychedelics expert at University of California, Davis. Growing awareness of psilocybin's possible mental health applications has led the FDA to label the chemical a breakthrough therapy for depression and anxiety, and the Department of Veterans Affairs is now participating in at least 5 trials of psilocybin and other psychedelics for treating PTSD and other conditions. Still, some researchers see dangers in the push to make psilocybin more widely available. What are they worried about? Psilocybin can trigger psychotic episodes and lead people to make dreadful decisions. An off-duty pilot riding in an extra cockpit seat on a Horizon Air flight last month tried to cut off the San Francisco-bound plane's engine mid-flight. Joseph Emerson, who was charged with 83 counts of attempted murder, one for each person on board, told police afterward that he'd been severely depressed and had taken magic mushrooms for the first time 48 hours earlier. He grabbed the emergency handles, he said, because he was trying to wake up from a dream. Some experts were skeptical, saying the drug should have been long gone from his system. Yet the American Journal of Psychiatry last year published a case study describing how a 32-year-old accountant suffered weeks of delusions, mania, and psychosis after taking mushrooms with friends. She required months of intense psychiatric treatment to emerge from crippling depression. "I am shocked at the legislative momentum for expanding psychedelics access," said Washington University psychiatrist Joshua Siegel. "Is broader legalization imminent?" The push suffered a setback in early October when California Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed a bill to decriminalize mushrooms and two other plant-based hallucinogens. "Do you really want people that are tripping on mushrooms driving cars?" asked Brian Marvel, president of an 80,000-member law enforcement organization that opposed the bill. The Horizon Air incident, which occurred 2 weeks after Newsom's veto, has only added fuel to such arguments. Psilocybin advocates in the U.S. are divided over the best path forward. Medicalized regulation is safer, but more expensive. In Oregon, a six-hour guided trip can cost more than $3,000. Decriminalization, however, might lead many people to think they can solve their problems by popping a shroom, something health experts say should occur in supervised settings in conjunction with talk therapy. The FDA is widely expected to approve psilocybin for depression by the end of the decade. But that will require clinical studies much larger than any conducted to date. The largest trial so far included 233 patients in North America and Europe. "What we don't know," said Fred Barrett, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research, "way outstrips what we do know." Moving into the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. Jonathan Chade at New York Magazine writes, "Fight hate, not Jews or Muslims." "Believe it or not," said Jonathan Chade, "you can oppose anti-Semitism without condoning hatred of Muslims or Arabs, and vice versa. It's a simple principle even a child could understand. But the right-wing political and media ecosystem is treating the Biden administration's condemnation of both anti-Semitism and Islamophobia as contradictory. On social media, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas assailed the White House for claiming Islamophobia is our top concern while posting a video of Vice President Kamala Harris clearly denouncing all forms of hate. Writers in the New York Post, National Review, and the Wall Street Journal have all assailed the administration's plan to develop a coordinated anti-Islamophobia strategy amid rising anti-Semitism, as if both prejudices could not be rising simultaneously. Just as elements of the anti-Israel left treat any sympathy for Jewish victims of the October 7th massacre as a betrayal of the Palestinian cause, the pro-Israel right often treats denunciations of Islamophobia as a tacit attack on Jews. Following the lead of Donald Trump, many Republicans embrace flagrant racism against Muslims, conflating them with Islamic terrorists. The biggest threat American Jews and American Muslims face is not each other, it's prejudice in general. The risk of shunning COVID shots. Americans are gambling with COVID, said Catherine J. Wu. As of mid-October, just 7% of adults and 2% of kids have received the latest vaccine, according to a Centers for Disease Control survey. Perhaps most alarmingly, only 8% of nursing home residents are up to date on their COVID shots. At this rate, the U.S. could be heading into the winter with the fewest people recently vaccinated against COVID since the end of 2020. COVID is far from the crisis it was then because nearly all Americans have some immunity. But quietly, COVID is still making lots of people sick. In fact, COVID still produces roughly twice the annual mortality that flu does. And roughly 17,000 people are hospitalized for the disease each week. Some people are still getting long COVID and being left debilitated for months or years. Missed vaccinations still translate into more days spent suffering, more chronic illnesses, more total lives lost, an enormous burden to put on an already stressed healthcare system. As the virus continues to evolve, the next terrible variant may eventually arrive, and vaccine avoidance could come back to haunt us. This column comes from the Palestinian territories. Will nobody hold Israel accountable? What's the point of international law if no one obeys it? Asked Ibrahim Shaban. As a Palestinian lawyer who follows these issues closely, I've lost count of how many war crimes Israel has committed during its month-long war against Hamas. It has hit medical centers in violation of many texts of international humanitarian law. It demolished residential neighborhoods, flouting protocols that compel countries to avoid civilian casualties. It has shelled dozens of mosques and three churches, turned two refugee camps into craters, and cut off 2 million people from food. 70% of the nearly 10,000 people killed in Gaza so far are women and children who bear no responsibility for Hamas' October 7th attack. Yet Israel callously declares them collateral damage. Had the Geneva Conventions simply disappeared? Europeans spent years of laborious diplomacy crafting human rights treaties, yet now European governments stand by silently as Israel shreds them. Of course, we hardly expect the United States to speak up, given its long record of international crimes in Latin America, its torture camps like Iraq's Abu Ghraib, its history of bombing other countries. International law apparently doesn't apply to the U.S. or to its proxy, Israel. Our in-depth article this week is titled, Russia's Manifest Destiny. The history of Russia's colonial expansion in Alaska is sordid and brutal, said Casey Michael in Politico. Understanding it sheds light on Russia's imperial ambitions today. In the racial reckoning summer of 2020, local leaders in a small American town gathered for a contentious vote on whether to take down a statue that honored a man who was, as one assessment read, steeped in racial division, violence, and injustice. Would they join local leaders from cities in Virginia, Alabama, and other states to remove a memorial praising a figure who symbolized a historical trauma that still caused anguish and anger among their constituents? The town council listened and debated and finally decided. By a margin of 6-1, the 7 members voted to join the flood tide of decisions elsewhere to take down another symbol of historic oppression. The statue, though, had nothing to do with the Confederacy or the Civil War. Rather, this vote took place in Alaska, in the small coastal town of Sitka, population 8,400, located on an island about halfway between Anchorage and Vancouver, British Columbia. And the statue was of a Russian, a merchant by the name of Alexander Baranov, a key figure in Russia's conquest of Alaska over 200 years ago. The resolution authorizing the removal said Baranov, who was Alaska's first colonial governor, directly oversaw enslavement of Tlingit and Aleut people, the policy that was often justified under a theory of racial and cultural superiority. Baranov's criminality, which included, among other things, the violation of Native women and murder and theft of indigenous property, was so depraved that local Tlingit named him No Heart. That removal of Baranov's statue never cracked into the national news cycle. And maybe that's understandable, given the protests rocking the rest of the country at the time. But it's also understandable for a related reason. Russia's colonization of Alaska and the rampant violence, spiraling massacres, and decimation of local Alaska Native populations that came along with it is hardly well known among the broader American body politic. It's also an overlooked aspect of Russian history inside Russia. Official accounts of Russian expansion suggest that Russia simply agglomerated neighboring peoples as part of its defensive acquisition of territory, happily gathering new peoples and new lands into Moscow's embrace. In Russia's telling, the word colonialism applies to only other empires, not to the Russian one. As Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov recently claimed, Russia has not stained itself with the bloody crimes of colonialism. But as the removal of Baranov's statue indicates, Russia's colonial legacy is hardly forgotten in Alaska. And given Russia's renewed lurch toward imperialism in places like Ukraine, that legacy is arguably more resonant now than it's been in decades, or perhaps ever. The story of Russia's imperial designs in North America traces to 1741, when explorer Vitus Bering first sighted Alaska's Aleutian Islands. At the time, Bering was searching for proof of a reputed great land that lay to Siberia's east, a semi-mythical outpost of untapped wealth that could enrich his benefactors back in St. Petersburg. There was nothing defensive or even natural about Russia's expansion into Alaska across the northern expanse of the Pacific Ocean. It was predicated on one thing alone, wealth, which could be stolen from whomever they might meet in Alaska. While Bering wouldn't live to explore this great land, he perished soon after, undone by scurvy. His shipmates quickly realized that the rumors of unbounded wealth in the form of a flood of fur were true. Just as Russian troops and trappers had scoured Siberia for riches like sable pelts, dubbed memorably as soft gold, Alaska proved a bounty of fox fur, as well as seal and other pelts. Hundreds of thousands of skins soon began flowing westward, adding to the coffers of Tsarist patrons in St. Petersburg. Of course, it wasn't Russian sailors themselves who were clubbing or shooting each of these animals. The Aleutian Islands and much of the southern rim of Alaska that Russian shipment explored already housed tens of thousands of locals, Aleuts and Tlingits, Inuit and Yupik. Nation after nation of Alaska natives already claimed a home in the region, largely untouched by European explorers. And then the Russians came. And just as they had among indigenous peoples in Siberia, and just as British, French, Spanish, and Portuguese explorers had done in the warmer climes of the Americas, Russian troops saw indigenous peoples as little more than a subhuman hindrance, but also as a potential means to an end. It didn't take long after the Russian landing for the familiar pattern of colonial crimes to play out, sending indigenous populations reeling. Almost immediately, Russian colonizers began implementing the same playbook they'd perfected across Siberia. The first step was known as Yasak, in which Russian representatives demanded tribute, furs typically from indigenous populations. In order to assure compliance, Russian traders implemented the playbook's second element, Amanati, in which Russians would seize hostages from indigenous populations held until the EASA requirements were completed. Often Russian representatives would kidnap the children of local leaders, all the better to ensure compliance. In some cases, as historian Anne Hyde has written, the Russians would abduct the children of up to half the men of a given community. For much of the 18th century, Russian rule in Alaska was largely driven by trappers and traders, diffusing across southern Alaska without any real organization. But a few decades after first contact, Tsarist officials formally chartered the Russian American Company to bring some order to Russia's shambolic conquest. Modeled on companies such as the British East India Company in South Asia, the RAC was nominally independent entity, granted the right to expand and entrench Russia's colonial holdings. Backed by the Russian army, the RAC's expansion wasn't difficult, sending employees across the broader Alaskan landmass and even exploring farther south along the Canadian and American Pacific coasts. And at the helm of the company was one man, Baranov, serving as the first formal governor of Russian Alaska, and a man who, as one Alaskan said in 2020, was responsible for murder, enslavement, rape, and a perpetrator of genocide, all on behalf of a distant czar. Few nations suffered more under Russian rule than the Alouettes. Battered by both Iasik and Amanati systems, Alouette populations went into immediate decline. But they hardly stood passive. By the early 1760s, just as British forces elsewhere on the continent were implementing new and wildly unpopular taxes on American subjects, Alouette men across the larger islands covertly gathered and plotted how to kill all the Russians. And at first, they succeeded. Far more familiar with the crannies and inlets of the Aleutian archipelago, Alouette men picked off wayward Russian invaders. Later, estimates placed Russian fatalities at nearly three dozen. One Russian ship attempted an escape, but was flung back by waves onto the shore, where Alouette infantry killed dozens more stranded Russian castaways. Russian retaliation was unsurprisingly swift. One Russian captain, Ivan Solovy, immediately unleashed a policy veering close to and potentially into genocide. Russian observers related how Solovy began killing dozens of Alouettes where he found them, murdering them on the spot amid terrible bloodshed, writes historian Claudio Sant. After 300 other Alouettes hid in a fortified structure, Russian observers later remembered Soloviev detonating the building, butchering the remainder with guns and sabers. As Sant added, Soloviev reportedly practiced a cruel experiment. Arranging the Alouettes in a line, he fired at the first to discover how many people the bullet would pass through. The slaughter was so atrocious that the sea around one island became bloody from those who threw themselves or were thrown into it. But Solovyev was far from the only Russian guilty of mass slaughter. Not long later, near Alaska's massive Kodiak Island, Russian colonizers shelled fleeing Aleutic men, women, and children, sheltering on the appropriately named refuge rock. Aiming cannonade at the defenseless Aleutics, the Russians carried out a terrible bloodbath, one Aleutic elder later remembered, with the stench of the corpses lying on the shore that polluted the air so badly that none could stay there. Hundreds died, some shot, some flinging themselves into the sea from nearly 10 stories up. Other remembrances place the number of deaths even higher, reaching into the thousands, and all of it without the Russians suffering a single casualty. As one archaeologist later said, the Russian massacre at Refuge Rock, which took place just a year after American forces completed their revolution against the British, was the wounded knee of Alaska. Russia never evinced any interest in actually settling Alaska. Russian nationals remain largely limited to Alaska's southern rim, often using its bases there for further ventures in the Pacific Northwest, California, and even Hawaii. There's little evidence Tsarist powers had much interest in actually governing Alaska as a constituent part of the empire. Even after a century of Russian control, by the time Tsar Alexander II offloaded Alaska to the U.S., fewer than 500 Russian settlers actually lived in the territory. Russian forces appeared interested in solely stripping Alaska of its bottomless wealth and using and abusing Alaska native populations for whatever they needed. Contra Lavrov, Alaska illustrates that Russians were motivated by unalloyed colonialism and were willing to resort to the most brutal methods necessary to suck as much wealth out of Alaska as they could find. In the 18th century, Russia conquered much of the Eurasian continent, eventually controlling lands from the Black and Caspian Seas in the south to the Arctic in the north to the far eastern Pacific coast, and subjugating dozens, if not hundreds, of indigenous nations, including Buryats, Chechens, and Tatars. But it was in Alaska that Russia's colonialist drive reached its apex. And it was Alaska that highlighted just how similar Russian expansionism was to European colonial projects elsewhere. If the awareness of Russian colonial crimes in places like Alaska were better known and better digested in the broader American body politic, events like the Ukraine invasion and the colonial underpinnings of such brutality would be far less shocking. Many of Russia's policies in Alaska were identical to other European colonial campaigns in North America and elsewhere. There was the outright enslavement of indigenous Alaskans, identical to Spanish mission-led enslavement of indigenous Californians. There were the massacres of unarmed Alaska natives, identical to the English slaughter of Pequot or French butchering of fox. And there was, all throughout, the Russian conviction of moral, even spiritual virtue to the entire colonial experience, indistinguishable from, say, American imperial expansion across North America and even into Alaska. Russia was no less a colonial empire than any other Western European powers. Mikhail Khodorkovsky, one of the leading scholars on Russian colonialism, has written, "Russia had been imbued with its own sense of manifest destiny since the late 15th century. And it is that manifest destiny that now plays out in Ukraine. As Putin has claimed, Russia is not simply another nation, but it is a state civilization that, as analyst Andrei Kolenikov wrote last year, has a special path laid before it, all part of Russia's thousand-year history. As Lavrov reportedly said, Putin has three advisors, Ivan the Terrible, Peter the Great, and Catherine the Great." It now seems obvious that Russia's monomaniacal obsession with empire drove it to invade Ukraine, and it was an unwillingness or an inability to view Russian expansionism, either then or now, as colonial in nature that blinded so many in the West to Moscow's actual designs. Unless the West grapples with this history now, the threat Russian imperialism still poses cannot be countered. Thankfully, that recognition of Russian colonialism is finally happening, but it's decades overdue. And it's that much more unfortunate that all along we had a clear case study of the phenomenon and the costs and the legacies right here in America. All we had to do was look. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in Politico. We have an obituary today. The decorated coach with a legendary temper. Bobby Knight, 1940 to 2023. Why did basketball coach Bobby Knight rip into his players so brutally? I'm trying to help them be the best they can be, he once said. I have enough of an ego to think I know better than anyone what's best for them. Knight was certainly a champion. In his 29 years at Indiana University, his team won the men's national titles in 1972, 1981, and 1987. And year after year, top recruits showed up knowing what they were in for. The general ran them at practices until they vomited. He swore at them at top volume during halftime. He kicked a player, his own son, during one game and allegedly grabbed a player by the testicles in another. Known for screaming at referees until his face matched his Hoosier red sweater, Knight had his most notorious meltdown in 1985 when he hurled a chair across the court after receiving a technical foul. Those tantrums led to his firing in 2000, not long after videos surfaced of him choking a player during practice. Knight was born in northeastern Ohio to a railroad worker father and a teacher mother, said the New York Times. He became a basketball standout in Orrville and went on to play on the 1960 championship team at Ohio State, where coach Fred Taylor labeled him a brat. A year after graduating, Knight enlisted in the Army to become an assistant coach at West Point, where he was promoted to head coach by age 24, said the Los Angeles Times. He went 102-50 over six seasons and coached Mike Krzyzewski, the future longtime Duke University coach, who bested Knight's all-time wins record. Knight's Hoosier squad was undefeated in the 1971-72 season, said the Washington Post, and he coached the 1984 men's Olympic team to a gold medal. But while players excused his furious and profane tirades, nobody could defend his rage off the court. He demeaned female reporters, telling one that rape victims should relax and enjoy it. And at a 1979 tournament in Puerto Rico, he was accused of assaulting a policeman whom he called the N-word, calling the Brazilian women's team dirty whores, and saying the island was only good for growing bananas. Knight, who coached briefly at Texas Tech after his firing, was utterly unapologetic. "Bury me upside down," he once said, "so my critics can kiss my ass." And on the Talking Points page, Biden, should Democrats panic over his polls? With a year to go until the 2024 election, new polls paint a dismal picture for President Joe Biden, said Stephen Shepard in Politico. A New York Times Siena survey of six battleground states Biden won in 2020, shows Donald Trump leading in five. He's up by 10 points in Nevada, six in Georgia, and five in Arizona and Michigan. Biden has shed support among Black, Hispanic, and young voters. Voters overwhelmingly trust Trump more on the economy, immigration, and national security. And 71% say Biden, who turns 81 this month, is too old to be an effective president. Those bleak numbers have injected new urgency into the simmering question of whether Democrats would do better with another candidate, said Aaron Blake in the Washington Post. The polls suggest as much. A generic Democrat fared 12 points better than Biden, leading Trump by 48% to 40. The numbers are alarming, said Dean Obadala in CNN.com, but not cause for panic. Then-President Barack Obama had similar polls a year before the 2012 election, before steamrolling Mitt Romney by nearly 5 million votes. The Times poll shows why many swing state voters could come home to Biden. They trust him more on crucial social issues like abortion and democracy, and 6% would switch their support to Biden if Trump is convicted and sentenced in any of his cases. Sorry, said Matt Lewis in the Daily Beast, but this is not 2012. Obama was a once-in-a-generation political talent who excited young and minority voters. And while the economy might improve further before next November, Biden's biggest liability, his age, is only going to worsen. Voters need to wake up and understand what's at stake, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. Trump's team is making plans for a dictatorship that should appall every American. The Washington Post reported this week that his cronies are plotting to weaponize the Justice Department to prosecute Trump's critics and to invoke the Insurrection Act on Inauguration Day, allowing the military to be deployed against protesters. At rallies, Trump is trumpeting his intent to rule as an authoritarian. Meanwhile, hapless progressives are threatening to withhold support from Biden if they don't get their way on student loans or policy toward Israel. If American democracy ends in 2024, much of the blame will rest with voters who failed to put aside their petty beefs and link arms at the ballot box to save the republic. Christian nationalism, a biblical future? Christian nationalists are gaining control over the Republican Party, said Marcy A. Hamilton in The Guardian, and they're waging a holy war to turn the government into a theocracy. In electing Representative Mike Johnson as House Speaker, the GOP has elevated a fundamentalist who has said, "We don't live in a democracy, but rather in a biblical republic." Last year, Johnson referred to his work in Congress as a spiritual battle for the survival of our country. In this crusade, Johnson will enjoy the powerful political and financial support of a legion of true believers, such as Federalist Society architect Leonard Leo, determined to turn their scriptural originalism into law governing all Americans, whether they agree or not. Having succeeded in overturning Roe v. Wade, Christian nationalists want to roll back LGBTQ rights, same-sex marriage, sexual privacy, and even contraception, making America a conservative Christian version of Iran or Saudi Arabia. That's not hyperbole, said Andrew Whitehead and Samuel L. Perry in Time. Johnson has explicitly embraced the idea that the U.S. was founded upon particular Christian principles and has denied that the founders called for the separation of church and state. Key tenets of his Christian nationalism include traditional gender roles, higher birth rates and larger families, and the belief that white Christians of European heritage should remain central to America's cultural identity and political leadership. Johnson and other Christian nationalists believe their struggle against liberal secularists must be won by any means, said Matthew D. Taylor in The Bulwark, which is why they played a critical role in Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 election. Before January 6, Trump met with the evangelical Christian leaders from a group called the New Apostolic Reformation, which calls for Christians to take over key positions of influence in society. Americans who believe in democracy should not underestimate how dangerous this movement has become, said Damon Linker in the New York Times. This year's American Value Survey from the nonpartisan Public Religion Research Institute found increasing support for political violence, especially among those who believe the U.S. is a Christian nation. Our democracy survived January 6 because a few key individuals sided with the Constitution. But next time they could decide that the country is in such dire straits that democracy is a luxury we can no longer afford. And we have time for a couple of the short notes. The U.S. infant mortality rate rose 3% last year to 5.6 infant deaths per 1,000 live births, the first such increase in more than two decades. Experts suspect the pandemic played a key role by making it more difficult for pregnant women to access in-person medical care. With nearly 11 deaths per 1,000 births, black infants have double the mortality rate of white infants. Of the roughly 5 million migrants arrested at the southern border during President Biden's first 2 years in office, 51% were subsequently removed from the U.S. Of the 1.4 million migrants arrested at the border during former President Trump's final 2 years in office, 47% were removed. Inflation raised the expenses of rural households by $8,120 in 2021 and 2022, higher than the $7,480 increase paid by urban households over the same 2 years, according to an Iowa State University analysis. Researchers at Cornell estimate 94% of U.S. job growth since 2000 has occurred in urban counties. And we'll finish the show today with a quote from Yogi Berra, actually quoted in Greensboro, North Carolina News and Record, who said, "You can observe a lot just by watching." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.